Hello, everyone, and welcome back to KPMG in Canada's State of Digital Assets podcast series. In honor of Fraud Prevention Month, today we will be focusing on Chainalysis. Starting with our KPMG participants, I am so pleased to welcome back our Digital Assets Center of Excellence. Could you please quickly start by introducing yourself and your roles at KPMG? Maybe we'll start with the man on the poster. Well, if we had a poster, Kunal, I'm coming to you first.
Thank you so much, Adam, and great to be back. Hi, everyone. My name is Kunal Basin. I'm a partner that co-leads the Digital Assets Center of Excellence here at KPMG in Canada. And I had the pleasure of working very closely with Chainalysis in announcing our strategic relationship recently with them. So happy to have some of our guests from Chainalysis here that I know will introduce themselves. But thank you, Adam, so much for hosting us again.
Always my pleasure. Su Ling, over to you.
Hey, everyone. My name is Su Ling Yip, and I am one of the partners at KPMG in the forensics division. And I have the pleasure of leading our financial crimes practice, as well as working very closely with our Crypto Center of Excellence on all things related to financial crimes and forensic in the crypto sector.
And we're so excited to have you too. Now let's get started by having our very special guest, Ian Andrews, Chief Marketing Officer at Chainalysis, set the stage. Ian, our research shows that it's best to start, well, at the beginning. So why don't we set the stage with your background, why you joined Chainalysis, and then we'll segue into how you describe Chainalysis in simple terms.
Adam, thanks so much for having me on the program today. Very excited to talk fraud and financial crime. For those of you that aren't familiar with Chainalysis, we're a software company headquartered in New York City in the U.S., but operating all around the world. Today, we've got over 1,300 customers that are a mix of public sector agencies in law enforcement, financial regulators, tax authorities, national security and defense, as well as in the private sector, banks, fintech organizations, and anybody that you can think of in the cryptocurrency space, from exchanges to mining companies to ATM providers, over-the-counter trading desks. So we really represent the broad cross-section of people that are looking to operate safely in the world of cryptocurrency and prevent illicit activity, protect their customers, really to navigate this new world of digital assets as easily and simply as you possibly can. Now, in terms of my background, I've been with the firm about 3 years, joined in January of 21 to build out the marketing organization. We've scaled the company pretty terrifically in the last 3 years, growing kind of 4x in that period of time since I joined. So it's been an amazing wild ride. As I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar, we've had quite a bit of ups and downs in the cryptocurrency industry during that period, a bull run followed by a crypto winter. And now it seems like we're heading back into another up market cycle. But all along the way, we've been really focused on building great products, working with terrific partners like KPMG, to make sure that we're solving some of the most complex problems our customers are facing and doing our best to make cryptocurrency safe for everyone.
You nailed it, Ian. I mean, the ups, the downs, and the headlines for crypto. Wanting to touch on that last part with you next, I mean, what are some of the major types of financial crimes involving crypto assets? I want to get into, what are some of the major financial crimes involving these assets that specifically Chainalysis software was using in terms of finding the evidence and building the case?
Yeah, well, here's what the amazing thing is it's pretty hard to find a type of crime that doesn't involve cryptocurrency these days. So I think for most criminals, there's a lot of appeal in cryptocurrency. You don't need to go to a bank. You can send it across a border globally for relatively low fees and with relatively little inspection along the way. So on the surface, crypto is really appealing. Now, I will say that with tools like Chainalysis, the downside of using crypto in criminal activity is all of your activity is recorded forever on a publicly available database or a blockchain ledger, if you will. So it makes it really hard to get away with the crimes. And it seems like the criminals haven't quite figured that part of the story out yet. But I think just to maybe enumerate some broad examples, we see crypto being used in narcotics trafficking, human trafficking, obviously, things like financial frauds. We've seen a massive increase over the years in investment scams, some of which don't even necessarily touch crypto. They use crypto words, but they're taking your very normal money and running off with it, and it never touches crypto rails at all. There's also ransomware is probably one of the biggest issues that I think we're facing collectively as a society. Predominantly that ransomware activity is coming out of Russia. So links to kind of state-sponsored actors behind a lot of these things. We're also seeing North Korean hacker groups who are quite prolific at stealing from crypto businesses, which obviously puts a lot of end user consumers at risk as well. So I can go deeper into any and all of these, Adam.
And maybe I'll jump on top of that, Ian, to add to what Ian was saying. I think if you look at the history of the cryptocurrencies, right, as the different types of currencies became available, sitting on the law enforcement or on the banking investigation side of things, right? Like seeing the off-railing and or the exchange between fiat and crypto. Certainly what I've seen, from a long, long time ago, historically, I think we started hearing more in the financial crimes community about this crypto, the Bitcoins and the different types of assets involving human trafficking investigation, unfortunately. Again, the industry and the public is becoming a little bit more knowledgeable now. Historically, there was this notion or this misconception, I should say, that crypto is fully anonymous. Hopefully we're trying again to demystify that. As Ian pointed out, it's not as anonymous as you might think it is, although there are some elements of anonymity. The controls were not as, I would say, as evolved as what you would see in a bank, but historically, I think where we started seeing it more and more in the financial crimes community was on the human trafficking side. And then you really saw that evolve to, criminals using it to evade sanctions. To add to what Ian was saying earlier, there's no borders with digital assets, right? So you can send things across the border. There's no report. You can try to evade reporting rules. So I think it could be as simple as tax evasion, sanction evasion. Of course, there's the usual suspects of drug trafficking. We're talking about, fentanyl trafficking, buying certain goods where you can, pay not just in fiat currency, but you can pay, via your crypto wallet. So I think there's so many different things that, that can happen. But I think the evolution of it, and I think what's great with, these tools such as Chainalysis now is that we are becoming more and more knowledgeable about, how to track these things down, and again trying to make sure that the sector is being used for the great opportunities that it is, and to prevent it from being abused by the criminals, because again we got to keep that in balance. We've got to help regulations come along. Again, the regulators are still trying to catch up. Like any new things, right? It takes a little bit of time for, for countries to develop legislation and regulation around that. But, I'm excited. I think I always try to take a balanced view that, yes, there's tons of financial crimes, but I think we need to continue to build those tools to try to deter, the bad actors.
Yeah, Suling, you mentioned human trafficking. Actually, one of the areas we've been researching recently at Chainalysis relates to this scam that's often described as pig butchering. And yes, the name comes from the idea because it's a long scam. It's not, let me send you a spam email and get you to click a link, but it requires that the scammer build confidence in the victim, which can take weeks to months often. And it typically results in very large losses from the victims, which is also unfortunate. But the story that's often less told is that the scammers themselves are often also victims. Many of the larger organized crime rings in Southeast Asia, operating out of countries like Myanmar and Laos, Cambodia, they're actually trafficking individuals, you know, often by offering them seemingly legitimate job. They get lure them into a compound where they're then often held with threat of physical violence and forced into sending you those text messages that you get. We've been collaborating with an organization called the International Justice Mission, who's trying to shine a light and provide some assistance to these people. And we were actually able to connect through on-chain analysis, both payments that were made by individuals who had been scammed in the pig butchering activity to ransom payments that were made from the families of individuals that had been trafficked into these organizations. So demonstrating directly that, you know, even the scammers are in this case, sadly, being taken advantage of. It's a really difficult situation. And unfortunately, most of that is happening offshore, outside the reach of law enforcement authorities in Canada or the US. And so while, you know, potentially billions of dollars are being lost in schemes of this type over the last few years, it seems very difficult to shut down the problem right now.
And maybe one more thing to add to that is, in addition to the actual crypto digital asset scams, there are even a lot of scams out there, again, that we see, again, in the financial crimes community that perpetrates, they're offering you crypto, again, because it's this hot, new and shiny, you know, thing in the market. It's hot. Everybody's talking about it. But we've even seen some scams where the victims think they're buying crypto when really they're not. Like, what they're buying, like, they're sending their fiat currency into this black hole thinking they're buying crypto when in the end, you know, they're not, you know, they're not really getting anything. So there's so many different, you know, variables, some that actually involve the digital asset that disappears. And then sometimes it's just you see that the fiat purchases on the banking side and the crypto transaction on the other side actually doesn't exist. So there's, you know, different ways of doing it, some that don't even, you know, involve actual crypto.
That's right. No, there's quite a lot of these scams that on the surface look like they're a crypto investment product, but in reality, they're completely disconnected from anything to do with the blockchain. Exactly. Now, I will say, you know, just to give people a little bit of good news and hope on this pig butchering situation, is a number of the cryptocurrency firms have been collaborating with the U.S. Department of Justice. Recently, one of the large stablecoin issuers and one of the largest exchanges participated in a particular DOJ investigation that resulted in $225 million. Worth of assets being frozen. So these were funds lost by victims of the scam. You know, ultimately, we hope to see that return back to the victim. So not all hope is lost, I guess, was my point I would share with the listeners.
That's a really interesting one, Ian, and I know specifically the case you're talking about. So, and I want to chat about, you know, stablecoin versus other crypto scams, right? So in the stablecoin scenario, as you mentioned, you know, there were parties that were able to come together, freeze those assets, and potentially would be able to return, let's say, the assets belonging to the people that were getting scammed. So what do you take out of that? Because that's not a possibility if you're sending, just say, let's say Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other crypto directly to a scamster's wallet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and this is pretty exciting in my opinion, that I think historically stablecoin issuers have generally operated under the mindset of decentralization, totally permissionless. And, you know, they, I think most issuers have abided by things like KYC and transaction monitoring rules, really only in their primary market sales. And you can think in the stablecoin world about primary market sales being between the issuer and a very large financial services business. It's not how you or I would acquire a Tether or USDC token, where we would go to an exchange and buy it. And so generally, issuers have looked at that secondary market sale or any secondary market transaction as being outside of their jurisdiction, effectively something that they don't need to regulate or look at, because it's likely happening, you know, between an exchange or a DeFi protocol or two individuals. And so they're being arm's length from the transaction itself, don't really have that obligation. That attitude is actually changing quite a bit here. And I think it led to the seizure that I described a moment ago. My expectation is over time, we're going to see these increase. And I think it will dissuade some criminal actors actually from taking advantage of stablecoins because of that technical difference in the issuing contract that allows for some of the assets to be frozen or repatriated back to original owners. And you're right, that's totally different than how the Bitcoin network operates, or even ETH on the Ethereum network, where once it's been sent, you have zero control over the asset. I think it's a great development that will ultimately encourage more people to have trust and believe that there is a level of safety in the ecosystem. So I'm all for it.
Ian, I have to say, you have infused some positivity where I wasn't sure it was going to exist. I was so worried today's episode was going to be doom and gloom, but it certainly does sound like cause for optimism. I want to keep that line, that tone going with my next question. So whether this is a preventative measure or it's just downright fascinating for us to discuss on the pod, I'm curious as to whether patterns have started to emerge here. Diving into fraud specifically, what types of fraud occur most often in the crypto asset space? Kunal, what do you think?
Yeah. So what I would say is, unfortunately, frauds and scams have been pervasive in the crypto asset space for as long as we've been in the space. And they have resulted in significant losses for users. And one of the key reports that we would typically look at is the Chainalysis crime report. And I do appreciate that they provide a particular number in terms of what is the estimated loss in terms of dollar value from these scams. And not only that, they do also a look back analysis and update their numbers as well. So I think for 2022, in the most recent report, I noticed, Ian, that initially, although when we looked at the crime report from 2023, the number was around $5.9 billion in scamming revenue. Whereas now, when you've provided your updated number in the 2024 crime report, that 22 to 22 number has gone from 5.9 billion to 6.5 billion lost in scamming revenue. So I do like the fact that you update these numbers on an ongoing basis, because these scams are the scamsters and their associated wallet addresses, they continue to come up front and be identified on an ongoing basis. And it's always good to look at it retroactively and update your numbers. Now, when we talk about what the typical crypto asset scams look like, and they really vary from a lot of different types. So you have ICOs, the initial coin offerings, which is really not one of the most leading type of scams in the crypto asset space today. It was earlier on, and especially in like 2017, when we had the ICO boom and had startups and individuals claiming to launch new crypto or crypto-related projects to raise funds. The other one I would say is Ponzi or pyramid schemes. This is no different from traditional finance, where schemes are promising really high returns to investors for doing little to no work, except for bringing in more and more investors. So really, the earlier investors are trying to get the returns funded by investments of the new investors, really creating an illusion of like a profitable business until the whole scheme collapses. We also know that there are phishing attacks in crypto, and these, the fraudsters are using phishing emails or fake websites and even social media. If you've gone on some of the social media platforms, you know how many fraudsters are luring around there, trying to attract you with high returns, etc., and wanting you to reveal your either private keys or sending crypto to fraudulent addresses. Now, another form of scam in the space is the pump and dump schemes. So this is really where groups of individuals are inflating the price of a lesser known crypto or like a meme crypto by spreading misleading information through social media or any other messaging apps, et cetera. And once the price is high enough, they would, the original group actually sells off their holdings for a profit, and it really causes the price to plummet down significantly and immediately as well. So that really leaves any new investors at a loss. We've also seen, you know, rug pulls, which is a typical scam in the DeFi or decentralized finance space. We've seen NFT scams, which really involves creation of fake NFT marketplaces or the sale of any counterfeit NFTs that infringe on IP rights or are simply really copies of legitimate NFTs. And Ian already talked about pig butchering. I think that's one of the biggest scams today. And Ian, maybe you can talk a bit about what you're seeing from your crime report and the trends that are trends that really would help people understand how to foresee these kind of scams and avoid these kind of scams from happening from them.
All right. So yeah, Kunal, I just wanted to jump on the point you made about this kind of pump and dump and rug pull scheme, because we actually did some analysis on this to try and understand what might be potential market manipulation. And keep in mind that we're looking at just on-chain data in this analysis. And there's actually a lot of information that I think you would want beyond that to really confirm for certain that something is a pump and dump scheme. But our analysis, we went and looked at all of the tokens that were issued on the Ethereum network last year. And I don't know if you've got a guess at that number, but it's pretty large. 370,000 tokens created last year alone.
Wow.
And a lot of these, you know, these could be, it's very easy to create a token. So it could be somebody experimenting, you know, just trying to teach themselves Solidity code or something like that. Doesn't, you know, really reflect like actual value creation necessarily. So we narrowed that number down a little bit. And we only wanted to look at ones that were actually available for trading on a decentralized exchange. So of that 370,000, about 168,000 ever got listed on a DEX. You know, and this varies throughout the year and through the month. Most of the tokens that get listed on a DEX never accumulate any meaningful amount of liquidity. Again, like you could suspect it's a student trying to learn something or somebody just playing around to see how all the technology actually works. So only about 14% of all tokens that ever got launched crossed that $300 liquidity threshold. But what we found within that group is almost half of them exhibited what appears, based on just the on-chain data that we see, to look like a pump and dump scheme, meaning that the token creator, once that greater than $300 threshold of liquidity is achieved, ends up withdrawing all of the other asset that was traded into the liquidity pool. And so back to, you know, the top, like there's a lot of fraud and market manipulation happening in cryptocurrency, and you need to be smart if you're going to be out there, because it's very easy to get sucked into the hype that Su Ling was describing, where it's like, oh, great, everybody's talking about Pepe coin or whatever the newest meme coin is. I should go buy some. Well, chances are there's somebody on the other side of that trade that's more sophisticated, more knowledgeable, and is setting you up to take all your money. So just be careful out there.
You know, Ian, you're getting to the practicality. And for our listeners, that's really why they tune in. They tune in because we are always trying to answer that question, what is in it for them? So let's bring it back to the people we do this for with our next question. Ian, I'm going to come right back to you. What can our audience do to further educate and protect themselves about frauds involving crypto assets?
Yeah, great question, Adam. I think number one, if a story sounds too good to be true, it is. You're not the one in a million exception where someone is actually going to offer you 400% interest or guaranteed 20% annual returns forever with no risk. Those things don't exist in any financial services product anywhere in the world. And so when you hear that story, be very, very skeptical. The other thing I would say is, like, crypto is technology. It's technically complex. It's very easy to trip yourself up and accidentally send an asset to a burn address. But there's some practical things you can do. If you're going to be seriously invested in crypto, you need to have a hardware wallet. You need to protect that digital asset just like you would cash, right? You're not going to carry thousands of dollars around in your pocket, probably. At least I don't. And you know, you need to think about your digital assets that way as well. You're not going to keep them on your phone if there's real value there. You know, you need to think about working with reputable and trusted institutions, ideally ones that are, you know, domiciled and licensed in the country in which you live. And I think if you do those three things, you're going to be better off than most. But obviously, you know, you need to be thoughtful. You need to do your own research. You need to actually understand what's happening in the market, because there's certainly people out there who do, and they're looking to take advantage of you.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ian. And I wanted to double click on the technical complexities involved in trading or investing in the space. And, you know, yeah, people can get cold wallets or hardware wallets, or they can create an account on an exchange, preferably on a reputable exchange. And now, if anyone wants to just get a little bit of exposure to this new asset class, there are ETF and structured products that are available to them in order to get that exposure through a traditional channel of going through a wealth advisor or a direct investing platform, right? So if all you want is a little bit of exposure rather than going to an exchange and going through all of the technical complexities that may be involved in setting up your own hardware wallet, you can actually get exposure to this asset class through ETFs and other structured products. So that I feel like is a significant improvement. And I'm, you know, based on the inflows we're seeing among the nine US Bitcoin ETFs over the last couple of months, we know that there was a pent up demand that was waiting for a product like this. So, like, my recommendation to most of the general audience would be, like, if you are not technically savvy, if you are not able to follow the space along, don't just try and fall into traps through someone online reaching out to you and asking you to invest certain fiat dollars or of your own crypto into a scheme. Rather, take advantage of the more mature structured products and more relatively, like, you know, regulated and compliant exchanges that are out there to be able to get that exposure from an investment standpoint. And maybe, like, a question for either, like, Ian or Su Ling here. Like, what can virtual asset service providers or exchanges in this case, like, how can they support the customers that they host in preventing getting targeted from these scams, or even, like, you know, losing money from these scams? Because there are instances where I've heard people are sending crypto assets from their exchanges to a scamster's wallet. So what sort of trends are you seeing there, and what are your insights to be shared there?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kunal. Actually, one thing I wanted to add, just again, just to kind of complete what both of you have said in terms of what can people in the general public do to sort of protect themselves. And I don't want to be overly simplistic, but I think one thing that I remind people of all the time is, similar to what you said, Kunal, like, you know, go through the beaten path first, but start small, right? And Ian, I really like the analogy you gave us. You know, do you walk around with $5,000 in your pocket? Like, nobody does that. So why would you do your first crypto trade or your first digital asset trade to be like your entire life saving? Like, why would you do that, right? It's no different than if you're starting to dabble into, you know, stock day trading. Start small. Definitely use a regulated exchange. And which brings me to my sort of, like, my next advice is, there are a lot of resources, you know, in Canada anyways, where you can actually look on the FinTrack website to see which crypto exchange is actually properly registered with FinTrack. Technically, their type of registration would fall under a money service business, because that's where most of the fintech fall under, which is a perfect segue into what can regulated entities do, right? So again, very easy. If you get even direct marketing, you know, from a particular exchange, or you hear a friend, you know, talk about a tip or and say, hey, you know, I use this exchange and that exchange, do your homework, start small, check their registration, right? Again, as I said earlier, the regulation and the regulatory framework in Canada and a lot of countries is still evolving, I guess, because it's still something that's fairly new. But I like the idea of, you know, that you gave of, you know, start with having indirect exposure through these exchange traded funds, the same way that you would have exposure to, you know, the equities market through mutual fund. Again, it's a very direct analogy. From a regulated entity perspective, you know, I could talk about this all day, so I'll try not to get that too excited here, but it's very simple, right? Have a proper compliance and AML program. That's number one. In order to get your registration and your license, the first thing that the regulators will ask you is, show me your policies and procedures. Show me, you know, what transaction monitoring framework do you have? Whether obviously, you know, we love chain analysis, but, you know, there are a few different tools out there, but you need to make sure that you have these very basic program elements in place, not just policies and procedures, because again, you know, that's just a piece of paper. You have to make sure that you've got the supporting processes in place, have a compliance officer. Those are some of the things that, you know, you put in place to demonstrate both to the regulators, but also to the public. Like, look, we take compliance seriously. And if you take compliance seriously, that means you take consumer protection seriously, right? And you're going to be on the more serious. You want to make sure that you're investing and putting the proper amount of resources towards a good compliance program, because sooner rather than later, something will come up, and you want to make sure you've got the right processes and the right defenses, again, to defend, you know, your customers from being scammed, or even your own firm from being scammed. So again, honestly, could talk about this, you know, all day. That there's a number of different requirements that apply to you. Again, a lot of these are listed on, you know, on the regulator's website, on the FinTrack website. It's all listed there. But, you know, take a look. There's a, you know, the FinTrack published their assessment manual. Take a look at it. If you're just starting, you're a small firm, you want to get your registration, take a look at, you know, what the requirements are in Canada and make sure that you have the bases covered, right? And then lastly, you know, very importantly, certainly not least, is, you know, make sure you're reporting on your large virtual asset transaction, again, which is a federal requirement in Canada, as well as any suspicious transaction reports that involve any of the digital assets that, you know, that you offer. So, you know, in a nutshell, again, we could, you know, probably give a course, you know, for several hours on this, but those are the bases.
Oh, Su Ling, how I wish we had that kind of time to dive deeper, but that may just mean that there is a follow-up episode in our near future. Ian, I want to come back to something that I've so enjoyed you bringing to the podcast. You know, perhaps my biggest takeaway from this episode thus far would be some of the mind-bending statistics that you have interwoven throughout the pod. I'm hoping I can impose on you to do it once again. So, looking at the latest Chainalysis crypto crime reports, what sort of insights can our listeners expect to get out of it?
Well, this is one of my favorite times of the year, Adam, because we come out with this blockbuster multi-hundred page research asset, and it really sets the baseline for how people talk about the industry. You know, we send it to policymakers and regulators all around the world. We send it to all of our law enforcement customers. And I think a lot of industry researchers look at this data as well to understand what is actually happening on chain. So at the high level, our analysis says last year in 2023, it was about $24 billion worth of illicit activity. That was actually down from 2022. Now, as Kunal mentioned earlier, you know, we revise these estimates up as we get more information. So 2022 actually increased quite a bit during the course of 23 as we found more information. But if we dive in a little bit into this $24 billion number, the interesting other side of the coin here, if you will, is that's less than 1% of all the transaction activity happening in crypto. So I find people regularly assume that crypto is all criminal activity. You know, 50, 70, 90% criminal activity tends to be their guess. And they're shocked when I say, look, this is less than 1% of all the transactions happening on chain can be clearly linked to illicit activity. So $24 billion, certainly a lot, something that we all need to work to bring that number down. But broadly, a very small part of what's happening in the crypto ecosystem. And maybe I can break down some of the interesting things happening in there. Probably the headline for me is ransomware. For the first time ever, we saw ransoms paid surpass $1 billion. And this is a change in the trend line. We had actually seen in 2022 a fairly significant drop year over year from 2021, which had been the previous all-time record high of ransoms paid. It seems like there were both some successful law enforcement interdictions where law enforcement took down the Hive ransomware strain that brought the 2022 numbers down quite a bit. We also suspect some of the folks who operate these ransomware rings might have been distracted by other global events like the war in Ukraine. But certainly they came back with a vengeance in 2023. Law enforcement and cybersec teams around the world are obviously working hard on this problem, but it's one that we can't stop looking at. The other big stat I'll share that we haven't touched on yet is that actually the amount of cryptocurrency stolen last year declined in dollar terms, which is pretty amazing. We're talking about billions of dollars of decline, which is unusual because the number of hacks actually was fairly close to 2022. And so what we've been debating this a little bit internally, is this just reflecting variations in asset prices, or are the platform operators getting better at playing defense? And while the attempts are still high in terms of the attacks, the value received from each attack has declined because our sophistication is getting better. As you called me, I'm the optimist here. So I would love to say that we're all getting better at security. I think it's probably honestly a mix of the two. Some market valuation changes, plus probably some improvements in security, has brought that value down. But we're going to keep a close eye on that here in 2024 for sure.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. I do want to highlight for the audience, we talked about a lot of different types of scams and frauds, but when we talk about the overall number, for example, like the $6.5 billion in 2022, that's not just all frauds and scams. There's a lot more risks in the crypto asset space. Those stats include any sort of like ransomware, money laundering, stolen funds, smart contract hacks, bridge hacks, like all of those things are also part of those stats. And that those may not necessarily impact a normal daily investor or normal retail investor, but it does definitely impact people that are more sophisticated in the crypto asset space and are more active in the decentralized finance or DeFi, as we call it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's we try and do as broad a survey as possible to collect everything that's happening on chain. But I always like to point out that on-chain activity is only one part of the total universe of frauds and scams. So, there's actually many cryptocurrency scams out there that have nothing to do at a technical level with crypto. There's been some notorious ones over the years where billions of dollars have been stolen. Victims were told that, their money was being invested into a hot new token or a new blockchain, when in reality, the scammers were just taking money and running away with it. And so that doesn't show up in the numbers that I talk about because it never actually happens on chain. It's a very traditional type of fraud. And so when you think about these numbers, keep that in mind. This is really information that we can verify through the analysis that we do using our technology here. And that requires that it's on chain. So we're not trying to scope in things that are happening beyond that.
Ian, one of the most refreshing things about having you as a guest on our pod has been that you're able to discuss both the advantages and the risks so eloquently. And as I look at the clock and wonder where the time has gone, we probably have time for just one more question. So I'm going to ask you to channel that infectious optimism one more time. Ian, my final question, despite occasionally being used to support financial crime, can you highlight some of the benefits of crypto assets?
Absolutely, Adam. So I think when we look at crypto, it's just like any other financial instrument that we see, where there's the instrument itself is neither good nor bad. It's all in the hands of the user. And so when I look at crypto, I think the stories I'm most amazed by, where we have individuals who are living in countries with exorbitantly high inflation, often complex, very restrictive capital controls, and in certain cases, you know, rule of law lacking government systems. Those people are effectively cut off from the traditional global financial system as you and I know it. You know, access to credit is very limited. The ability to transfer money across borders is very difficult. You know, their local currency may not be valued at all outside the country because of capital controls. And so cryptocurrency represents a path to financial freedom and independence, right? People can now you know, send money internationally. They can transact globally. They can do that with relatively low fees. And while crypto is often critiqued as being highly volatile in terms of the asset prices, when you think about it relative to countries where they're experiencing, you know, triple-digit annualized inflation, I think I would actually argue something like Bitcoin might be a little safer. And when you talk about stable coins, particularly those that are dollar-denominated, that's often a lifeline for people in countries around the world where really they want to be able to hold on to that dollar-based asset, but they're not actually able to hold, you know, traditional dollars in their country, and stable coins become an incredible proxy for that. So I think we're doing, you know, the industry is delivering a great service to those across the global South. We've got massive, you know, room to go to stop some of the illicit activity, certainly. But there's some really good things happening out there as well. Su-Lin, what do you think?
No, I have to agree with you, Ian, because, you know, we were talking also earlier about, you know, ensuring that people have, you know, even access to basic necessities. And in certain countries, you know, again, where the political landscape isn't as stable, sometimes it's a matter of, you know, can I, you know, purchase some medical supplies, or can I purchase even, like, again, some of the basic day-to-day necessities? And we found that, you know, that's one method. The other aspect, and that's not even just in other countries, even just in Canada, we see a lot of human trafficking victims that, you know, don't have credit, you know, because of obvious reason, like they've lost their identity and they're trying to rebuild sort of like their financial independence. And again, there's a lot of different, you know, good, humble ways, you know, that you know, crypto can contribute to. So it comes back to, you know, making sure that we as an industry keep it as a level playing field and keep it as a stable, you know, financial system that, again, people can rely on.
Yeah, I'd like to just add a couple more points there. So totally agree with you, Ian and Su-Lin. I don't think I've seen anyone here working in the financial services space in North America say, yes, we absolutely need crypto or stablecoin, because we have relatively mature infrastructures, financial infrastructures, and access to various banking for the public. But the rest of the world, and especially like developing countries, they don't have those facilities. And people that haven't been there, haven't seen the situation that these people are living in, their paychecks losing value pretty much to like half or more than half in a day. Those are the kind of people that are really able to take advantage of stable coins, especially to store their wealth, to store the value of their paychecks as well. But at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, we're talking about crypto assets, but there's a lot more to just the cryptocurrencies in it, right? Like, there is innovation happening in the space. We know there's tokenization is becoming a real trend. So tokenization of real world assets, that is, I think every research report that I read is talking about how this could potentially become a $1 trillion industry by 2030. So, and I feel like that's where the real innovation is. So just taking what is happening or what has happened over the last, let's say, 10 years or 12 years that crypto has been in existence, yes, initially there was more use of crypto in for illicit activities, but at that time we didn't really have the infrastructure to be able to trace these transactions. And you know, since the time organizations like Chainalysis and some of the other crypto intelligence firms have basically improved their infrastructure to a level where we're able to track these transactions, monitor these transactions on almost a real-time basis, and also do look-back analysis, a lot of those risks have been subsided today. So we're seeing the advent of more and more infrastructural capabilities to be able to not just monitor, but also like conduct investigations on these blockchains. And also with the initiation of like whitelisted addresses, et cetera, there's a more permissioned environment that's emerging within the digital asset space. And, you know, frankly, like that's one of the reasons why we rebranded our team's name from Crypto and Blockchain Center of Excellence to Digital Asset Center of Excellence, because crypto and digital asset is a lot more than just Bitcoin, Ethereum, et cetera. There's real value and real innovation happening in this space, which a lot of the firms will start to take advantage of.
I couldn't possibly think of a better ending note than right there, Kunal. If you had a microphone, you'd probably drop it. I mean, I know you have your headset, but please don't drop that. Want to just jump in and say thank you all so much. The discussion, the statistics, the concepts covered today, they've really highlighted the significance of Chainalysis in the crypto industry. I say it every episode, but only because it's true. Look, I've seen the Outlook calendars. I know firsthand how busy you all are. So I have to just say how much we truly appreciate each and every one of you taking part, especially our special guest, Ian. Unfortunately, that does mean we are out of time for today, but we will be back. And maybe by then we'll get Kunal his well-deserved poster by next episode. I don't know. Join us then on KPMG Canada's State of Digital Assets Hot Bite series. Bye, everybody.